welcome to the alternative media. I'm your host, Patrick Slattery. We have a great show planned for you today. This should be exciting. First, we are going to have an interview I conducted earlier this week with Professor James Petras of New York State University at Binghamton. He is one of the leading scholar on issues of Judaism, Zionism. He didn't make his mark in that field. He made his mark more in Latin American studies, but a very interesting interview with him. And just before we get that rolling, okay, well, it is ready. Let's go for that right away. Let's hear that interview. Director, can you please play the clip?
Hello, Professor Petras.
Yes.
Hi, this is Patrick Slattery.
Oh, yes, let's talk.
Okay, great, thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. I've been a long-time fan. Okay, well, first of all, so you are a professor emeritus at the State University of New York at Binghamton?
Yes.
Okay. And you've talked a lot and written a lot about a Zionist power configuration. How do you define the Zionist power configuration? Where does it operate geographically and institutionally? And what are its power resources?
Well, let's start one at a time. The Zionist power configuration is an organized unit that goes far beyond simply a lobby, in the sense that a lobby would be a group organized in Washington that would be pressuring on existing power organizations, mm-hmm. like the Rifle Club or whatever. Now, the Zionists are different in several senses. One, they are actually in government. That is, there's a whole range of officials from Treasury Department to Pentagon, military, mm-hmm. and the State Department, the advisory organizations that especially deal with the Middle East, and similar structures. They also have media influence in the principal media, in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, among others. Mm-hmm. They also have direct influence in terms of financing politicians through multi-million dollar and billion dollar organizations that have a direct tie to U.S. policy and support for Israel. So that's a sample of what I mean by the Zionist power configuration. That is to say, it goes beyond simply a pressure group organizing on congressional voters, congressional Congress people. So that's the first question. What was the second question?
Where does it operate geographically and institutionally, and what are its power resources?
Well, its principal focus is in Washington on the Congress. Its second focus is nationwide in particular regions like New York, California, but it goes across the country. They have organizations, particularly if you look at the members of the 51 or 52 principal American Jewish organizations. Mm-hmm. They have a spread across the nation in practically every state in the Union and probably in most major cities, where they have the Jewish organizations that are affiliated with the principal organizations. So they have enormous leverage far beyond merely saying New York and Washington and mm-hmm. Los Angeles. And they are able to use networks to stigmatize and slander and fire and exclude educated people and others who criticize the Israeli policy. And they're a single-issue organization. Whatever is good for Israel, whatever ruler is in Israel, is supported. They're totally uncritical. They don't debate issues. They transmit issues.
Okay, and now you mentioned earlier the proliferation of Zionists in the Treasury Department, the State Department, Defense Department, and elsewhere. If there was a threat to Zionist positions and privileges in government institutions or academic institutions, would this also be something that Zionism would oppose? Is it strictly single issue, what's good for Israel?
No. Anybody that criticizes Israel, whether they're in government or out of government, whether they're in academia or not in academia, the organizational structure would go into play. As you see at the universities, the movement for boycott, divestment, and investment, they have been constantly attacked by Zionist structures, naming people, getting people fired, blacklisting people, stigmatizing them in faculties, what have you. They have a blacklist they run and they promote. Doctors have also been criticized. Lawyers have been criticized and scandalized. Not just criticized, but scapegoated and slandered.
Okay. I saw your recent article on, I guess it was something about meritocracy in the American government. I forgot the title of it, but it was on Ron Unce's site. I don't know if that was just something Ron Unce picked up.
Ron Unce publishes practically all my stuff.
Okay. And are you familiar with his article from a few years ago, the Myth of American Meritocracy, and he looks at Ivy League admissions?
I saw it. I don't recall it in great detail. But he was very critical of the way in which they manipulated entrance and so forth, but I'm not up to date on it.
Okay, yeah. One of his findings was that even after correcting for things like PSAT scores or other academic achievements, other measures of academic achievements, Jewish applicants were much more likely to be admitted to the Ivy League schools, the elite schools, compared to non-Jewish whites. And it was something like a 14-to-1 ratio. It was astounding, but, you know, you have a situation in Harvard, for instance, where you have about 25% Jewish student body, according to Hillel. And when you do the math, you look at the provost data on other racial groups, there's only room for about 20 or 25% non-Jewish whites after you subtract out the others. So that also seems...
Well, that fits in with what we've seen in the Supreme Court, where you go 40% Jews, 0% Protestants.
Right. So I guess
there's clearly a political influence here, political power, money, organization, etc.
So, for the Zionist power configuration, is it simply to protect Israeli interests, or is it also to protect the interests of the Jews in the diaspora as well?
Well, I think it's the overlap here with, I think, a lot of influence that overlaps between a well-to-do and influential Jews who are also happen to be supporters of Israel, and I think they reinforce each other.
I see.
There is also a great many Jews that don't go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, probably a great majority, over, well, you say 25%, but probably about 75% of Jews don't go to the Ivy League schools.
Right. Now, your recent article, of course, was pointing out the prevalence in our State Department and other places of Jewish individuals who had come out of the Ivy League schools.
Particularly individuals who deal with the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
There's where you have an extraordinary imbalance, if you will. Anybody that's called an Arabist or who has a balanced position is usually shunted out or created pressure on them or insults and marginalized. So you saw this very clearly with the Bush and, well, it goes back to Clinton, Bush, and Obama. There's a great overrepresentation. And then if you look at the economic dimensions, too, you find that all the people
in the Federal Reserve,
you'll find that it runs back quite a few years. And that, this is, you even get officials from the Israeli Federal Reserve that come from the U.S. and go back to the U.S. There's virtually no differentiation.
So the current
Fisher,
Stanley Fisher, was the head of the Bank of Israel, and now he's the vice chair of the Fed.
Right. Now he's pulling the strings for the U.S. federal policy.
So
Yellen.
Yes.
Yellen and Fisher.
That's right. How would you define Zionism? So your conception of Zionism...
Zionism is the belief that Israel has supreme allegiance and that Israel has a sacred policy because of its descendants from the people of God. So it has a religious dimension, it has a ethnic political sovereignty that dictates policy above and beyond anybody's national embodiment.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter if you were born in the U.S., if you become a Zionist, you're first and foremost an Israeli.
Israeli Jew. I see.
Because there are Israeli Arabs.
Right. Now, moving to the State Department, I was actually visiting the State Department about a year ago, and I did pop into Victoria Nuland's office, the Assistant Secretary of State.
Kagan's wife.
And
yeah, Nuland is a long-time Zionist, and goes back time. That's not a real name. She's
Noodleman.
Her father's name was Noodleman.
Yeah, that's right.
And she has been 100%. And she has been not only involved on Israeli issues, but been involved in
Russia. And Ukraine.
No, Ukraine.
Right. And Professor Stephen F. Cohen, who writes a great deal about Russia, has talked about her and other officials as having kind of a vendetta or even a jihad against Putin. And if you think of the events that unfolded in the 1990s in Russia, where you had a privatization with a great deal of input from our Treasury Department, from people like Lawrence Summers, as you know, that resulted in a takeover of the Russian economy by largely Jewish oligarchs, why is it that you would have our State Department, and is this kind of, why would you have this Jewish or Zionist agenda against Putin? How does that fit within your...
I don't think it was against Putin. I think it was against the Russian people. Insofar as they stripped the economy, privatized, and concentrated, as you said, 8 of the 9 top oligarchs were of Jewish background and became citizens of Israel, by the way, among other things. Now, that's an interesting question that you raise about the connection between U.S. State Department officials and the rise and concentration of wealth among Jewish oligarchs. I have not really studied that in detail, but it's an interesting hypothesis to examine the implications and raise some interesting hypothesis about why and how that came about.
Yes. Well, you did have Lawrence Summers, who was at the Treasury Department. You had Peter Orzag, who was a young man at the time, but you might be familiar with him. He wound up being
Yes, I know who he is.
Yes, and then Jeffrey Sachs and other people from Harvard were among them. I'd like to ask you about, well, you were a professor of Norman Finkelstein. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
yeah, one semester, I think.
One semester. And I saw a debate between the two of you, and you were debating basically, I guess, whether
the power of Israel and its role in making U.S. policy. And he was following, to some degree, Chomsky, who's a total snow job on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not quite as bad. Chomsky's the worst on the power of Zionism. Though he criticizes Israel and he uses virulent and vituperous language on Israel's role, he's opposed to BDS, for example. And he never has taken up the issue. He's ignored all the facts about the issue, about who votes for who and why, who funds the voters for Israel, etc. He totally ignores all the factual documentation. But Norman takes it up and says it's one factor. Where I on Middle East policy, I say it's the dominant factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I'll say this, that Norman paid a price for that, because they went for him, including his nemesis at Harvard, Dershowitz.
Alan Dershowitz, yes.
So, in a way, he paid a price for ignoring the central role that Zionists play in undercutting criticism of Israel.
So, that leads me to the question, what motivates somebody like Noam Chomsky or perhaps Norman Finkelstein to contend that Israel
well,
is an instrument
Norman,
of American imperialism?
I think you have to separate.
Okay. Well, then
I think Norman has, to some degree, attacked the Zionists and Dershowitz and others. So, I mean, compared to most non-Jewish writers and academics as a whole, his position is much better. Chomsky is another fish.
Okay.
Chomsky has deliberately avoided this issue, and one can speculate why. Is it his earlier ties with the kibbutz, with Israel? Is it some underlying commitments that he has? Is it a way of protecting himself from getting even more rabid attacks from the pro-Israel crowd? You can guess on what's involved, but it's clearly one of his major deficiencies.
Though
he's made other errors, his analysis of Latin America has been off the mark several times.
Well, those were my questions. We're left to speculate what his actual motives are, whether he's trying to protect his own position, whether he's actually trying to protect Zionism in a way by distracting attention from the Zionist power configuration. Well, how about this? How important is Zionism to our politics? Is it just one of many competing forces?
No,
or is it
it's
central
the
one?
Most important policy on the major area where we've had the most important wars in the last 25 years.
So you cannot understand American
we
politics.
We have had wars where? In the Middle East against Muslim countries, Iraq in particular, Afghanistan secondary, Lebanon, and in every one of those instances, the Zionists played major role in making the U.S. the principal actor. Israel doesn't have an impact on China policy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Israel doesn't have an influence on U.S. Latin American policy. It doesn't have an effect on Asia policy, but it does have a major influence, the major influence in the Middle East, in particular, overwhelming influence in the Iraq War.
Do you think it has an influence in our relations with Russia? Right now we are dangerously close to war with Russia.
Yes, but Israel also has relations with Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure of the details of it, but they have met and have discussed and shared policies. I don't think they agree on major issues, but they don't lead to any Russian denunciation of Israel on any major scale or scope.
Mm-hmm. Here's another question. Why are so few people in academia willing to speak out about Zionist power, especially in the social sciences, which are in the midst of it, and you know, people in the social sciences are trained to understand the structure of society and its power relations, yet almost all of them keep their mouths shut. Are there any academics
who
can...
let's say, first of all, we got to screen out people that are ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, people who are apolitical, that don't want to speak out on anything. They got their heads buried in their little projects. Then of those people who are at any way involved, there's fear. Why become involved? There are others that are associated with prominent Zionists in the government. So some of it is political association.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is intimidation and fear. And another is opportunism, wanting to get ahead. I'll let you know that I get all my stuff published on Latin America, major publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came up with the first book on Israel, all my publishers turned me down.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, this is too controversial. Some of our readers are book users in our classroom. Classroom book will not... like to read books put out by someone who's very critical of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
There's intimidation, there's blackmail, there's ostracism among those people who are knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm. And have you suffered any adverse consequences from your outspokenness?
Oh, sure, including death threats.
Including death threats, I see.
Yeah. Insults. Including by left critics.
Mm-hmm.
The left critics are awful talking about Zionists. They have refused, and I'm talking about small magazines.
Mm-hmm.
New Left Review, for example, has not published any serious study. They may have recently published something about a year ago or something, but none of the major left-wing journals. I think a lot of them are cowards.
Are you familiar with Gilad Atzmon, who, regarding...
Yes, I wrote a press blurb for him on his first book.
The Wondering Who. His conception of anti-Zionist Zionists?
Yeah, I'm a bit bothered by that. I think he's... There's something there, but I think he exaggerates it.
Mm-hmm. I see. I interviewed recently Professor Kevin MacDonald, the psychology professor from...
Yes, I know who he is.
And are you familiar with his work?
I've read a couple of his essays, yes.
And do you feel that he's onto something?
Well, he covers a lot of ground. I'd say he makes some interesting points, social psychological points. Others, I don't buy in.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't keep a file on him.
No. Okay.
All right. Have a good
afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Bye.
And I'll send you the transcript. Bye.
The music's starting. We will be back at the top of the hour, and you will not want to miss this. Andrew Anklin, Don. It myself, Patrick Slack.
He's the Sheik of Arabia, as you can plainly see. At night when he's asleep, into his tent he'll creep, and the stars that shine above will light their way to love. He rules his land with sheep, the Sheik of Arabia.